Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today the Honorable Congressman from Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District, Jake Auchincloss. He's a Democrat, and you may be, our listeners may be wondering, why are you having a congressman from one of the coasts talking about heartland political issues? The reason, and there are several reasons which will become apparent here, but the reason, one of the main reasons is I saw a feature about Congressman Auchincloss in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago, really talking about some fresh ideas, new ideas. And I think more than anything else right now, our country really needs new leaders, new ideas. And I think this is somebody that is intriguing, and I think our listeners will enjoy hearing. And that's why I'm so happy and pleased that you took the time to be with us today, Congressman.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on.
The thing that I guess was interesting to read in light of everything going on right now in the Wall Street Journal is your view on what's called social order. Could you talk about that a little bit and why that's so important, not just for the Democratic Party, but for the country?
One of the defining features of Trump has been the chaos that he wreaks. And I think society's hunger for a sense of stability and order. Individuals do, and groups do. And the common trend amongst immigration and inflation under Joe Biden was that it felt like we weren't in command, that between price instability and border insecurity, things were unraveling. And Trump, in many respects, campaigned as a strong man who could bring order to the chaos. He has not done so. He has threaded chaos through daily lives and high politics alike. And my view is one of the promises of the Democratic Party needs to be the party that can uphold social order. So stable prices, law and order, national security, fiscal responsibility, public morality. These are issues that some of our listeners may associate with, you know, the Reagan brand of republicanism. I reject that. These are principles that are universally appealing. Reagan had his own spin on the ball, but Trump has fully abandoned them. The guy who wants to defund the FBI and overturn a free and fair election is not in favor of law and order. The guy who rolls out a red carpet for Vladimir Putin is not the national security president. The guy who adds $5 trillion to the national debt is not the fiscal responsibility avatar. Democrats can take those issues and we can substantiate them with our own policies. But first, we have to embrace them. And I worry that too many in our party are afraid of saying, hey, I'm a law and order Democrat, or I'm a national security Democrat, or I'm a believer in balanced budgets. Why should we be afraid of saying that? Absolutely, we believe those things. And here's how we're going to do them.
I just talked with the mayor of Rockford, Illinois, just yesterday, and he expressed frustration on the crime issue, that crime rates are going down, yet people still don't feel secure in their neighborhoods. Is there, and I get both sides of this, both things can be true, where crime is going down, but people do feel a little insecure. Is there that feeling you've seen, you know, in polling showing people are worried, but yet rates are going down? Was this one of the things I think that the party falls for? And that look, all the data shows crime's going down, but they don't understand the visceral feeling people may have and where they live.
I think there's two phenomena. One is that more coverage of violent crime is being imported to people's personal media consumption because of social media. It used to be you watched the nightly news reported on crime in the area, in your geographic radius. Now, because of social media, crime from as far away as Southeast Asia gets imported into people's daily news feed. And so it creates a cacophony of crime around people on a day in, day out basis. And the way our brains work is we're not, our brains are meant to respond viscerally to threats to our physical safety. And social media has hijacked that mechanism. So I think that's one issue. There is also another issue, and this is something that we have to govern on, which is it is absolutely true that violent crime, gun crime, aggravated assault is going down in most blue cities and red cities. It is also true that open air drug use, that shoplifting, that loitering, that depredations on property are going up in many scenarios. And that matters too. It matters if you go to a CVS and you can't buy shampoo because it's locked behind the container. You know, it matters if you're trying to walk to work and you're stepping around needles. It matters if you go to the playground with your kids and there are mentally ill individuals yelling things on the sides of the playground. Like, that stuff matters. It bothers people. And we should stop it. If we're going to be the law and order party, it's not just about supporting checks and balances in Washington. It's about, you know, picking up the trash around public spaces.
Well, why is it? I mean, the Democrats are perceived to be weak on what social order, and I think that's a fair criticism, especially in big cities. Is that something that the party's just going to have as a kind of an Achilles heel moving forward? I mean, are there examples of mayors doing a good job in big cities with? What was it? Prince, our governor said the other day, well, we're always going to have crime. And, you know, is that too flippant of an attitude? Do you see where I'm kind of going with that?
Yes. And I'm glad that you asked for good examples. It's so easy to point fingers and criticize, but it's harder to uplift. And I think we should uplift. You know, Mayor Mike Johnston in Denver has basically ended veteran homelessness and is well on his way to ending homelessness, period, in that city. He has, you know, radically reduced a lot of different measures of social disorder, again, whether it's the open air drug use or otherwise. And he's not doing it in a cruel and callous way like you would see from these MAGA thugs, right? This is not about pulling up unmarked vans and grabbing people off their bicycle. This is about integrating mental health into first response. This is about providing more emergency shelters and housing first solutions. This is about substance use treatment, but it is also about getting the police walking on the beat and upholding the law and enforcing the law. And it's an integration of those tools that can be very effective. The new mayor of San Francisco, actually, you know, San Francisco during the pandemic became kind of a punchline for Democrat-led disorder. The new mayor is turning that stuff around. He is, and you know what he's doing? He just, every day, he's out in that city walking around. He's going to the worst spots. He is walking around. He's got his phone out. He's calling his city managers. He's saying, hey, we got a problem here at this corner. We got a problem there. And he is just, it's management by walking around, as my father-in-law used to say. And there's no substitute for it.
Well, and I think in fairness, too, on the other side of the coin, that there's a lot of crime in red areas as well. This has been pointed out, red
gun
states.
Violence,
so,
in particular. Yeah. This is where Democrats should go on offense. There's a lot of talk about us modulating our views on gun safety issues. I'm actually not fully sold on that. I think there's a way that you talk about it. You don't want to condescend to legal gun owners. You don't want to act as though gun ownership is somehow, you know, outside the mainstream. It's not. There's many, many legal gun owners who respect weapons and want to teach their children to respect weapons. But I absolutely think we can lay this at the feet of the Republicans. They're trying right now here in Washington to make it so that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms can't enforce laws against creating your own weapon at home that can bypass a metal detector, a ghost gun that's has no metal parts and is unserialized. How is that a law and order issue? Really? Like, that's what this country needs, is the ability for people to walk through metal detectors with weapons? This is the Republican Party today.
I just had as my guest a couple of weeks ago, the author of a new book on gambling, and he, raising red flags about the prevalence of gambling, especially with young men. And online and on phones. And I read a piece you wrote in the New York Times about digital dopamine. And it kind of all came together, how this is working and the problems we have with big tech. Could you talk just a minute about the thesis and you wrote in that Times op-ed, please?
Yes. And before we talk about digital dopamine, just a word on what dopamine is. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical in your brain, and it is a very primal chemical. So it's been around since brains were first evolved 500 million years ago in little worms in the ocean. And what it does is it is basically a reinforcement tool. It basically, it emits when you're expecting pleasure. And whatever you were doing that caused this expectation of pleasure, the dopamine basically tells your brain to feel good about it. And so it really is the vital tool of your reward circuitry in your brain. And it's, as I said, it's deep inside your brain. This is primal terrain. It's the most valuable real estate in the world, because the corporations that can hack your dopamine circuitry can get you doing more and more and more stuff. They're basically able to inject a drug into you, but instead of the drug causing behaviors out in the real world, the drug causes you to consume more and more of the online content that they're creating. We're seeing this with social media. We're seeing this with pornography. We're seeing this, as you said, with online gambling. And I actually think online gambling, as it relates to young men, is probably the most perverse example of digital dopamine. These corporations, they're cutting out the real world. There's no in real life effort, sweat, striving necessary. It is simply scrolling, getting you software bits, programming dopamine hits. And I think a lot of Americans for the last 15 years accepted the view of these tech titans, well, that this was the future. Every new smartphone version, every new app that was developed, this is the future. And if you can't get on board with this, then you're just some Luddite and, you know, come on, like you're just some out of touch boomer. And I'm somebody who led MIT's entrepreneurship competition. I worked as a tech product manager. And I'm in Congress on the committee of jurisdiction of these companies. And I'm here to say, this is not the future I want for my three young children. I don't want their brains programmed by corporations. I don't want them to have AI friends that Mark Zuckerberg produces, as Zuckerberg has bragged about. I want them to have in real life friends. But to do that, we need to change the way our laws and markets work. We have stacked the deck in favor of digital dopamine, and we've made it too hard to build stuff in real life. And my call to action in this piece is to say, one, we need more regulation on the gambling, on the social media, on the pornography, not nanny state stuff, but for children, real restrictions that make sure that their brain development is not being warped by these trillion-dollar corporations. But then in the real world, we got to make it easier to get stuff done. It is so hard to do anything in the real world. You want to build a house. You want to start a business. You want to get a train station developed. You're talking like 10 years and so much brain bleeding. If we want people to strive in the real world, for goodness sake, let's cut some of the red tape and build stuff in this country again.
I'm glad you brought that up, because another guest I just had on wrote about that, Mark Dunkelman's book on why we can't get things done. And you got this whole abundance agenda by Ezra Klein, which is out there and basically talking about we got to get things done. If I could do one more book reference, a book I'm reading right now, and I hope to get the author on, Dan Wang has written a book called Breakneck about China and how they're able to build things so quickly. How are we going to break through this? This is an issue. It seems like we can't get anything done quickly, not quickly, I don't think that's the word, but as soon as possible, and especially in comparison with other countries.
Without doubt. There's a stale debate right now within the Democratic Party that basically says, well, is it government or is it the corporations that's the problem, right? And the traditional left will say it's corporations. The center left traditionally will say, well, sometimes it's government, sometimes it's... I find that debate so unhelpful, because the truth is we got to do three things to get building again. One, we have to cut regulations that are standing in the way. Absolutely. Sometimes government is the problem. If it takes 15 years to permit a new clean energy facility, that's a problem. It's ridiculous. If it takes 7 years to build an apartment building in a city that badly needs housing, as many in Massachusetts and elsewhere throughout the country do, that's a problem. We're 5 million units short of housing in this country. We got to build a lot more fast. We got to build more ships in the Chinese Navy. And it's way too hard to do that. So yeah, cut the red tape. Doesn't mean that you go Doge style slash and burn it all down. Do it thoughtfully, right? Like, regulations are there for a reason, but of course you can streamline it. But number two is you got to take on special interests that are keeping prices high. And that absolutely includes corporate profiteering. We talked about the social media and gambling corporations that I think are taking advantage of Americans, but also look at health insurance. Look at the pharmacy benefit managers. Pharmacy benefit managers are the middlemen of drug pricing. They're owned by the health insurance titans, and they make hundreds of billions of dollars a year doing nothing, so far as I can tell. They don't research any new drugs. They don't distribute the drugs physically. They don't own any pharmacies. They're literally just, they're just paper pushers in the middle of this whole thing. Of course, we should take them on, and I'm the lead of some legislation to do that. And then finally, we should be adopting technology that allows us to build stuff faster, better, cheaper. you know, I'm someone who has a lot of concerns about technology as it relates to digital dopamine, but I'm very pro-tech if it means we're going to build nuclear power plants, offsite construction of housing, the ability to build high-speed rail faster. Like, absolutely, let's use technology to solve some of the world's hardest problems.
The pharmacy benefit managers, aren't those in one of your pieces an example of what you call cost disease? I thought that was an interesting term to apply, but it's throughout a lot of the economy and key sectors related to kind of the middle class getting ahead.
Treating cost disease should be the cornerstone of the Democratic economic agenda. What is cost disease? So we're all familiar with inflation. That's for darn sure. The thing that I think is less obvious, or at least it comes up less in everyday conversation, is that inflation is not spread evenly across the economy. Some parts of everyday life are actually getting cheaper over time. You know, buying a TV today versus 20 years ago is actually a lot cheaper now. Some parts of our life are getting way more expensive, going up way faster than wages are. And the most afflicted with cost disease are housing and healthcare. These two sectors have cost disease. And when you get your rent bill or your mortgage bill, when you get a health insurance premium bill, what you are seeing is a bill that is afflicted with this condition. And this condition arises in sectors that are very broadly in demand, very labor intensive, and very low in productivity growth. And what we have to do as Democrats is say, we are going to treat cost disease in housing, healthcare, and probably utilities as well, because the middle class cannot feel financially secure if 50 to 60% of their take-home pay is being eaten up by just housing and healthcare. And that's about where we're at today. All right, so you know, how do we talk? How do we treat cost disease? Well, some of the things that we just discussed, it's adopting technology aggressively. So for example, offsite construction of housing and fixing zoning. It's taking on special interests in healthcare, as well as expanding the direct provision of primary and preventative care and expanding the use of generic drugs. But it requires, I think, a much more specific premise and conclusion than we traditionally have talked about. Democrats have talked, I think, too broadly about, you know, we're the party that's going to lower prices for the working class. Well, I actually think voters want to hear the explanation of how precisely we're going to do that and in what sectors we're going to do that. And housing and healthcare, we need to be top two.
Listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. He's a Democrat, former city council member, which I hold near and dear because, as listeners know, I served on a city council. Local government's critical. Knowledge of that, I think, is a great training ground for being in Congress. He also served in the Marine Corps, we've been talking a little bit about what attracted me to him as far as being a new voice, new, fresh leader for the Democratic Party and the country, and some new thinking that I think we badly need. One thing I noticed in doing a little research on you, Congressman, is your district includes Fall River, which I looked it up, and it's kind of similar to a lot of the Midwest towns in our region, the old factory towns. Yours is an old mill town. Yes. The college attainment's lower. It's an older community, and it's struggling to get back on its feet to some degree. How do we do that? I mean, would you discuss the role of trade? I mean, trade's hurt a lot of our factory towns here in the Midwest, and there's a part of us that look at what Trump's doing on tariffs and thinking we needed this to kind of protect our industries, but yet maybe the implementation wasn't the best. But how does that apply not only out here, but also in communities in your area like Fall River?
Fall River is the biggest city in my district, almost 100,000 individuals. It's a multi-ethnic working class city and has voted Democrat every presidential cycle since Calvin Coolidge until 2024 when it went for Donald Trump. And I'll tell you, on election night, I did not stay up to watch the results because I had my poll watchers in Fall River. And when I saw that happen, I knew it was going to be a long night for Democrats. Fall River, not at all immune from the general trends, the pushback against immigration and inflation under the Biden administration, I think was big drivers of this. But you asked specifically about trade in particular. And it's interesting because actually, one of the more prominent business owners in Fall River just wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal explaining how Trump's tariffs have hurt his manufacturing business. He's a textile manufacturer. It's kind of an archetypal business that people presume can't make it in America these days.
And his point, which is a point that I think is overlooked oftentimes in the debate on trade, is that free trade is not just about expanding markets for your wares. It's not just about, I want bigger markets to sell into. It's also about lower input prices for manufacturers here in America. Things are cheaper that he imports to help build out his factory. And the higher input prices are what's really hurting him right now, making it much harder for him to compete both domestically and internationally. So the Trump tariffs are not helping him. Doesn't mean that tariffs have no place in the world. My view is we should be thinking in terms of trade gravity, not trade deficits. This focus on bilateral trade deficits is meaningless. It doesn't affect anything. A bilateral trade deficit is an accounting fiction. It doesn't actually tell you anything about things that impact people's lives. What does matter is how supply chains work internationally. Do the critical value add parts of supply chains thread through our country? That's what we want. We want the high value manufacturing production elements threading through our country. And absolutely, we should use trade policy to accomplish that. And part of that trade policy should be tariffs on China, which has been cheating on the terms of trade and has taken some of those high value elements of the supply chain through through illicit tactics, including slave labor. But some of it should also be expanding our trade ties with our allies in Europe and Southeast Asia and Africa and Latin America. It does not help farmers right now to have their soybean market cratered because of a poorly conducted trade war with China that had no elements of, that had no alliances and operating systems for us to plug into to help soak up that demand.
Congressman, what I'm hearing here locally on the ground in this area, which of course is, you know, an Obama-Trump area, it's been kind of a bellwether in the past, but people, I think in the middle that aren't really partisans on either side, people in the middle are concerned about what Trump is selling, but boy, they don't see anything that the Democrats have right now. And it just seems like the party leaderless with good policies, or is the party suffering from bad policies, or is it messaging? What do you see right now in that vacuum?
I think Americans don't know what we're for. We've spent a decade telling Americans who we're against, which is Donald Trump. I think Americans are pretty clear about that. Democrats don't much care for the dear leader. And his approval ratings are the same as they were a decade ago. So we need a new drum to bang on. My view is we have to explain to people what we would do with power that makes us worthy of their vote. And I think of it in my sort of like simple, my simple politician's brain is basically across three elements at its core: cost, corruption, and classrooms. We talked about cost disease. The cost of housing, the cost of healthcare are suffocating the middle class. We need to be the doctors of cost disease. We will come in and we will make it so you're spending much less than half of your take-home pay on these core elements of financial security, okay? Number two is corruption. Washington is corrupt. It is corrupt. This administration is the most corrupt administration in history. We need stock trading bans for members of Congress. We need to abolish partisan primaries and gerrymandering. We need to get the big money out of politics. We've got to establish a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. We have a lot of work to do to clean up the stables after this administration, and also recognize that it's on both sides. And I think Democrats need to be more plain about this. And then finally is classrooms. This is something that just doesn't get talked about. New reporting today that 12th graders are reading at their lowest level since 1992. Probably of the 50 million American public school students, probably 25 million are behind grade level in either reading or mathematics. That's a national catastrophe. And a big part of it was the school closures during the pandemic. Those school closures were a catastrophe. They were unnecessary. And I'm not saying that as a Monday morning quarterback. We were talking about that in May of 2020. And indeed, my day one issue when I took office was to reopen the schools in fall of 2020. We as a party need to build 1,000 trade schools, surge one-on-one tutoring to every student who's behind grade level, and take back education as an issue from Republicans who have no plans for the classrooms and only want to talk about bathrooms. Democrats should be the party that says, listen, like, we're going to deal with the trans issue in sports, and I get it, it's complicated. We're going to figure it out for different levels and you know, types of sports. And yeah, we get it, it's complicated. We're going to work this out. But our focus is going to be making sure your kid is good at reading and mathematics.
I got time for one more question here. We got about 2 minutes, a little over 2 minutes. James Carville's famous saying with Bill Clinton's campaign in 1992 was the economy, stupid. And there's a lot of talk now that maybe the economy isn't the biggest issue, that Republican voters, a lot of working class voters, since Democrats have to get back, maybe see their interests lie in the cultural issues, guns, things like that. And I find that to be true with a lot of people around here. Maybe the economic interests aren't on top. What are your thoughts on that, and how the party needs to position itself strategically with working class voters in light of that?
The economy matters. The economy is central, but people will not hear our ideas for the economy. They're not going to hear Jake Auchincloss talking about cost disease or housing or health insurance premiums if we are condescending. It's not that we have to map on to every cultural belief of every voter. It's not that, you know, I'm a strong gun safety advocate. It's not that I'm not going to flip my position on guns out of political whim. I have strongly held beliefs about these issues, but I work really hard to not be condescending about it, because nobody wants to be lectured. And boy, Democrats have a reputation for preaching and talking down to folks. Okay, this is how I feel about guns. This is why I got there as a father, as a Marine officer. This is how I feel about it. You feel differently. Okay, good thing we're Americans and we can debate through deliberative democracy and wrestle with this issue. We cannot condescend to people. I think we don't give voters enough credit for their ability to disagree and move on. Say, hey, don't agree with you on that one. I understand how you're thinking about it, and let's talk about other issues now. And you're seeing effective politicians like Andy Beshear, I think, and Roy Cooper, who have proven that you can do that, right? And I think that as a party, if we stop condescending, we can start talking about the economy in a way that resonates.
That's a good way to conclude our interview today. Jake Auchincloss, the congressman from Massachusetts, 4th District, has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. I think listeners will understand now why I had him on. Very interesting person with some fresh ideas, and I think you'll be hearing more about him in the future. Congressman, thank you so much for being my guest today.
It was a pleasure.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.